Ursula, like we always do at 10 o'clock on a Tuesday, we got a guest.
I know, and we couldn't get her at a more opportune time. It is Dr. Angela Rasmussen. We're going to bring her in just a moment. The governor, just want to remind you, has a news conference today at 2:30, and he's expected to update his Safe Start plan. What is that all going to mean? Will we see an extension of the ban on indoor dining and gyms, or will it be lifted as expected on Monday? And also, health experts are now saying that that more contagious variant of COVID that forced a national lockdown in the UK is likely here in Washington. So let's bring in Dr. Angela Rasmussen right now. We are so lucky to have a virologist who joins us every Tuesday. Thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Good morning, Ursula. How are you today?
Well, good, except that there's so much news that is, frankly, troubling, including this new COVID variant that first popped up in the UK. As you know, it's so contagious that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered another national lockdown. And we are told that this new variant is likely here in our state. So what should we expect?
So in terms of having another lockdown, I'm not sure that we should expect that, because I don't think that we can actually do that without providing a substantial amount of economic support to allow people to actually do that. But what we should understand about it is that while this variant is more transmissible, meaning that if you're exposed to it, you will have a higher chance of actually becoming infected, it's not being transmitted in any kind of different way. Mm. So while I completely agree that it probably is already here in Washington State circulating undetected, people should really take this as a warning to really double down on their vigilance about the existing means that we have to reduce exposure risk and transmission. And that means that people need to be extra conscious, extra conscientious about wearing masks in public places, about physical distancing, about avoiding gatherings and enclosed environments, et cetera. People really, really, really need to focus on that, because this new variant does seem to be much more transmissible.
Okay, just a follow-up on that, too. So we know that it is more contagious, but what do we know about the current vaccines, the ones that are being administered right now? Do they work against this variant?
So we don't know that for sure, some early studies seem to indicate that the mutations in the spike protein, which is what the vaccines are directed against, in this variant, are not likely to completely evade immunity from the vaccine. So that's the good news, although I would caution that that's very preliminary and studies are ongoing to make sure that that is in fact the case.
Dr. Rasmussen, hey, talk to you in a while, buddy. Happy New Year.
Hey, G. How you doing?
Good. So apparently you've been gone a long time, because I asked our listeners for questions and I can't keep up. So here we go. I really can't. Here's one. Dr. Rasmussen, if you've had COVID, do you need the vaccine? And also, if you've had the vaccine, do you still need to wear a mask?
Yeah, so those are both great questions, and I do have answers for both of them. Right now, there is no indication that previously having COVID is any kind of contraindication for the vaccine. And because we don't know how long having COVID and developing immunity as a result of that will last, people who have had COVID before are being recommended to take the vaccine along with their other people in the priority groups that they are in. So if you've had COVID already, definitely you should still consider getting the vaccine. And in terms of, I'm sorry, G, remind me of your second question. It's been a long morning.
That's all right. And the next question of, if you've had the vaccine, do you still need to wear a mask?
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much for filling in that little brain fart that I had. So yes, you do still need to wear a mask. And the reason for that is that right now we know that the vaccines in the phase 3 clinical trials are very, very efficacious at protecting against symptomatic COVID-19. We don't know for sure how well they can protect against infection or how likely they are to reduce transmission. Now, my speculation is that because they are so efficacious at preventing symptomatic disease, they probably also offer a substantial measure of protection in terms of infection and the ability to transmit the virus. But because we don't know that for sure, until we have that data, we should definitely exercise maximum precautions, given that the variant that is circulating in the U.S. Is more transmissible.
And this comes from Lisa from Seattle. She asked, can you be a carrier of COVID-19 even if you have immunity of the virus?
That's a really good question. And my short answer is probably not, but that kind of gets back to what I was just talking about with regards to the vaccine. While we know that there is protection against symptomatic disease, we still really have a lot of knowledge gaps in terms of how well long-term protection, whether that's from a vaccine or from natural infection, protects you from being infected and potentially from being an asymptomatic carrier, somebody who might be infected and shedding virus that you could potentially transmit to others. So until we find out more about that, again, we should exercise maximum precautions.
During his last press conference, Governor Inslee said that schools are not where COVID is spreading. What do we know as far as this new variant, though, about if it would spread in schools?
So there has been some really conflicting data. Initially, in the UK, they were suggesting that that children were more susceptible to the new variant, but it's not clear that that's actually the case. Right now, and this is true of 6 months ago, and I think this will be true as the pandemic continues on, is that with regard to schools, if we have community transmission that's occurring at such significant levels that there's really no way to avoid it, no matter how many precautions you're taking to make the school environment safe, then that does probably call for closing down schools. If we can get community transmission back to a lower level, and again, right now, community transmission is higher than it's ever been, with this more transmissible variant going around that has the potential to get even higher, we really do need to think seriously about potentially closing schools and keeping people at home as much as possible. Because right now, I'm very, very concerned with the effects that this could have on our healthcare system. I think a lot of people have been hearing about the variant and thinking, well, fine if it's more transmissible, but I've heard that it's not more virulent. It's not causing more severe disease, and that's true. But it's still really, really dangerous. And that's because in many places throughout the U.S., hospitals are at or about to be at capacity. If we have another surge of people getting infected on top of the existing surge that we have, that could really push our healthcare system past its breaking point. And that will in turn lead to more COVID deaths. That will also lead to more deaths from causes that are not COVID but are indirectly caused by it. For example, if you get into a car accident and you need to be taken to the hospital and go into the ICU, but that hospital's already full of COVID patients, then you might start to see people dying for other reasons because they can't access healthcare that would normally save their lives. So that's what people need to be thinking about when thinking about everything from schools to the kind of gatherings that they're engaging in, the kind of behavior and the precautions that they're taking when they do go out in public. We really need to try to reduce community transmission as much as possible in every way that we possibly can.
And I had a story this morning that said that the hospital bed and the ICU bed rates here in Washington are over 80% filled. Is that worrisome?
That's very worrisome. And it's especially worrisome because actually Washington State, out of all the 50 states, is really among the best.
Yeah.
We have one of the lower rates of COVID prevalence here. If we're at 80% capacity, then think of what's happening in communities where they're at 0% capacity. And I might also take this opportunity to say that it's not even just the beds, because we can get more beds in more buildings. That's not entirely the problem. The problem is also having enough staff to actually provide that medical care, because it's not the hospital bed that's providing care to the people in the ICU. It's the physicians and the respiratory therapists and the nurses and all of the people who are working in the hospital environment providing that health care. And that is a limited, you know, that's a finite supply. Mm-hmm. And those people are also getting sick. They're exhausted. They're burnt out. So that's the other part of the healthcare system equation that I think doesn't get enough attention.
Okay, Dr. Rasmussen, here you go. This comes from the 425. Is the new variant actually from the UK by spread, or is it the natural evolutionary process of viruses because we slowed the spread, or the more transmissible strains could spread? So like all living things evolve, is the spike proteins evolving?
Okay, that's a really good question. Let me start with where that originated. It was originally detected in the UK, because in the UK, they do a lot more genomic surveillance than really anywhere else in the world. They sequence about 10% of the COVID cases that they detect. And maybe I should just explain what genomic surveillance is. That's when you basically have a COVID case, and then you sequence the entire genome of the virus that's causing that COVID case. That's how we can detect different variants that might be emerging. That's why this was probably detected in the UK. Did it emerge actually in the UK, or was it brought there from someplace else? We don't really know, but that's also entirely a possibility. It's possible, though, that it was just detected in the UK because they do more genomic surveillance there than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Now, whether, you know, there was some kind of selection pressure created on by reducing community transmission that made this evolve to become more transmissible, probably not. And really, the way that mutation occurs is it's a completely random process, and it occurs every time the virus replicates its own genome. Basically, mutations are essentially typos or errors that occur when the genome is replicating, and they can be good or bad or neutral. They can have no effect. Any mutation that provides some type of competitive advantage to a variant will be selected for. We call that positive selection. So it's clear that this mutation did provide some kind of competitive advantage. It made it easier for the virus to infect new hosts. And that allowed it to become very prevalent. So we would say that this variant was under positive evolutionary selection, but really what the causes of that selection are very unclear, because we also don't know the mechanism by which this variant is more transmissible. And that could be several things. It could be that people who are infected are shedding more virus. It could be that it binds the cellular receptor better and is more efficient at infecting cells. It could be some type of interaction that it has once it has infected a host cell that allows it to replicate to higher levels, or that allows it to evade the host immune system. And we just don't know right now, but those experiments are in progress. But that is a really fantastic question that I was just asked.
Well, I want to be transparent. Like, anytime I have questions, I mean, I don't just wait for you to come on the show. I'll text you and I'll say, hey, should I be worried? And what about this? And what about that? So thank you for doing that. But my question for you is I always, what's some good news? I mean, outside of the vaccine starting to happen right now, what is some good news that you are happy about right now at this time?
Well, I mean, apart from the vaccines, not a whole lot. And actually, even with regard to the vaccines, I'm pretty disappointed with how problematic the distribution and initial rollout has been. Right now it's very hard to say that I'm happy about anything that's happening currently, because we are in a very, very grim situation. And I know that I've said this periodically over the last year, but it seems like we keep going backwards instead of going forward. I think, though, that as people are getting vaccinated in higher numbers, I can see a little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. And that's what I'm, I think, the most hopeful about now, is that even though currently things are very difficult, because of the vaccines, and that is really a huge scientific achievement as well as something wonderful for all public health. I do see hope in the coming months that we're going to get past this. And, you know, somebody, I was talking to a colleague who reminded me that after the 1918 influenza pandemic, then we had the Roaring Twenties. Then we got back to our normal lives, and we had a period of time that was characterized by wonderful art, by, you know, wonderful social changes for many people. And I think that we need to keep that in mind, that even though this is a very, very difficult time, better days are ahead.
Okay, so I've got another question from a listener wanting to know if the COVID vaccine has an impact on fertility, in particular for women. Are flu vaccines, COVID vaccines, and other vaccines all the same when it comes to fertility issues?
So no, not all vaccines are the same with regard to fertility issues. But we actually, unfortunately, don't have a lot of information about that with the COVID vaccines. And this was, I think, a real oversight that pregnant women and women who are breastfeeding were not enrolled in the clinical trials. So we weren't able to rigorously look at this. Now, that said, there were a number of participants in the trial who did become pregnant while they were participating in it. And so far, it doesn't seem that the vaccines have any adverse effects about that. There was no higher rate of miscarriage, for example, and it seemed that people in both the placebo and the vaccine groups got pregnant at about the same rate, suggesting that there's no issues with fertility. But ultimately, this is a wait-and-see question, although the early data is encouraging. And I know that some of my colleagues who are frontline healthcare workers who have gotten the vaccine are pregnant, and it is being offered to pregnant people, even though it hasn't been explicitly tested in those groups. So people who are pregnant are still getting access to it, and many of them are choosing to be vaccinated. So we should have more information about that in the coming days.
Dr. Rasmussen, thank you so much for your time. We sure appreciate you.
It's my pleasure, Ursula. Anytime.
Tell Taz hello.
Will do, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Hey, coming up next.